Okay, I see that you've chosen another composer who's active in film music, as well as the concert stage, Oscar Navarro.
That's correct. This Spanish composer, a living composer, a clarinetist himself, has written two clarinet concertos, and this number two is absolutely a dynamic opportunity to show off the ability of the clarinet, the sound, the color, and it has such a beautiful, appealing sound to it. I really love this composition. When Frank Cohen, our soloist, who, as we probably know, has been with the Cleveland Orchestra as principal clarinetist for 36 years, I believe it is, and has not only played concerti with the orchestra, but has recorded with them and has been a world-class soloist for many, many years. The reason I wanted to play this piece is because he suggested it to me. I originally wanted to do the Mozart clarinet concerto. I always wanted to do that with him, this kind of the real meat of the repertoire.
Yeah.
But he said to me, you know, he says, I've played that piece so many times. I've recorded it with Cleveland and others, other orchestras. He says, I've recently have found this piece and made friends with this composer in Spain, and would you be interested in listening to it? So I said, all right. I kind of was hemming and hawing. I hung up the phone, and I called him back in 15 minutes after I listened to it, and I said, it's on. It's fabulous. I love it. It'll be great. And it's really a dynamic piece. Did you get a chance to hear it yet, George?
I have not. I don't have a recording, so I'm looking forward.
You can YouTube it. It's actually recorded in Spain with a Spanish clarinetist. It's a very fine live performance.
Okay.
So people can get a chance to hear it before. And like you said, it does have that wonderful film quality to it, which means easy to listen to, really great rhythmic aspect, and beautiful colors and timbres too. And he specifically in the score would like to hear, see in the orchestra setup, meaning where the strings lay out, where the winds and brass and percussion lay out. He wants it to have a certain setup because he has written it to have a stereo effect.
Oh, great. I love it.
So one side of the orchestra will play something, and then the other side will echo it or do something in tandem or like a conversation going back and forth. A really cool thing. Now, that's not a new idea. For example, take Mozart, for example. In any of these little fugue situations where the setup in the old days could be with the first violins on the normal left of the conductor to the audience, and then they put the second violins to the right of the conductor where the cellos now sit.
Uh-huh.
Even in the Baroque period, but into the early classical period, a lot of that antiphonal and fugue writing was going back and forth with these voices. So it's not a new concept. It's just a concept that's a little more modern and a little more dramatic now, specified by the composer.
Yeah, I was going to say he's channeling his inner Monteverdi or Gabrielli. But
Exactly right.
Since we're about to go to Copland, is there any similarity at all to Copland's clarinet concerto, which is such a nice piece, or is it different?
That was another piece. It's totally different. That's a piece that I also discussed with our soloist, Frank Cohen, because he had told me in conversation a couple of years ago that it was through that recording that I believe Benny Goodman made.
Yeah.
Because the piece was written for Benny Goodman, mm-hmm. from what I understand, who we know is a great jazz player, but also was a serious classical player and wanted to extend the repertoire. It's a very difficult piece. It's a little edgy, even for Copland, I think.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way?
Uh-huh. Copland even wrote a little serial music, didn't he? And it sort of approaches that kind of sound in a slight sort of way. Yeah.
Yes, it's not what the typical things like the Appalachian Spring that we hear, or the Outdoor Overture, these kind of things. You're right. It's a little more edgy, and he really wrote well technically for the clarinet, and Benny Goodman certainly played it beautifully. You can hear those recordings.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any connection in the Copland.
Well, Copland. Well, he wrote some film music, too.
That's right.
Quiet City is one of them, I think. Certainly the Red Pony. You guys have to do the Red Pony Suite someday.
That's a really
love
great.
That piece.
You're right. That's a really cool piece.
So Appalachian Spring, the ballet commissioned by the great Martha Graham.
Martha Graham, the great choreographer and friend of Copland. Yeah, it's really great. And, I mean, the Appalachian Spring. Now, I always wonder, how did this great kid, Jewish kid from Brooklyn, New York, come up with this idea to write music that we now identify, when we hear Copland, we think of Americana, American music.
Oh, yeah.
And now how did he saddle that name, that title, and why do we feel that way about it? You know, I often wonder, in his style of writing, is it because of his open fourths and fifths that he uses a lot in the chord? And this way we feel that this is wide, vast space, like maybe the Wild West and the open areas of the West in the old days when pioneers were moving out that way? Or is it the jagged, rough rhythms or altered measures by 2-4, 3-4, 4-4 in meter that we feel that the rocks and the terrain might have envisioned or felt like or sounded like. I don't know what it is. And yet, he's Appalachian Spring gives us a perfect sense of what Appalachia would be, the lifestyle, the mood, and the technique. Now, the funny thing about this whole thing, the title Appalachian Spring was not the original title.
That's correct.
As a matter of fact, he wrote this ballet music entitled A Ballet for Martha, meaning Martha Graham, his friend. And afterwards, when it was titled Appalachian Spring, and he actually saw the productions and figured out what was going on, and everybody's giving him his accolade for doing such a great, great work in this commission, he said in his own words, I had no idea that I was writing music of this nature for Appalachia. He simply was writing music, ballet music, that was supposed to be danced to by his friend, choreographer Martha Graham.
Yeah, and I'm just reading something that Fred Callen was a well-beloved NPR classical music fellow back in the old days, and he said that Copeland was often amused when people told him he had captured the beauty of Appalachians in his music, that he told him that. Little known is that the word spring out of the Hart Crane poem denoted a source of water in the Crane poem, but the poem is itself is a journey to meet springtime. And here's a verse that I found from that, from the Hart Crane poem, The Dance, from a collection called The Bridge. O Appalachian Spring, I gained the ledge, steep, inaccessible smile that eastward bends and northward reaches in that violet wedge of Adirondacks. And I've never stumbled onto that before.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. So I guess it's good to be famous for something you didn't really know you were, what you were doing, huh?
Yeah. Sure paid some bills.
He hit it out of the park, and then they labeled it, and it was a big success. It's funny that he was able to see the humor in that even in his own lifetime.
And all those sections of the ballet which just go together seamlessly.
Right.
In the suite.
This is that beautiful, simple gifts tune that everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a childhood tune that we use to learn to play the recorder, or you hear it maybe even in a church hymnal that's been used in so many different textures and colors, and he uses it beautifully and develops it very beautifully, too.
Just a plug here. Many people know the orchestral version. If people want to listen a little further, we need to tell them about the chamber version.
Yeah, the chamber version actually is the one I do the most. It's for 13 musicians, including a piano and single winds and brass, and actually, I think that that's the most beautiful version of the piece because it has some kind of delicacy, lightness, and can swing very beautifully with a smaller ensemble. It's chamber music at its best. With the orchestra, it's, you know, you try to achieve the same concept, but, you know, instead of two first violins, we have now 12 first violins.
Mm-hmm. You just don't have the natural agility there.
That is correct. So, you know, in finding the right tempo for the concert hall, it has to be treated just a little bit differently to get the same effect that what you're looking for. With the chamber group, you can do it in a smaller setting. It can be very sprite in tempo and very delicate and light and nuanced, just a bit more. But it's still very, very lovely.
All right. Probably three of the most famous opening chords by Brahms, that F, A flat, F, that brings in the first movement of Brahms Symphony No. 3.
Yeah, and he uses it so beautifully, and again, and again, and again. That's one thing about Brahms. I mean, it's funny because, like an archaeologist, you know, as a conductor or a musicologist, you have to kind of, you see what he does in the first movement. And then you see how he takes things, hides them, flips them around, switches it around a little bit, and hides them in all other movements, and generally makes a big return or less subtle return in the final movement of his symphonies. But if you listen carefully, he's underlying these tonalities and that sequence, and you think, wow, I don't know how I know this. If it's your first time listening, for example, and you're sitting in the concert hall for the first time, and you hear the first movement, wow, fantastic. But then it's going to be hinted all the way through the symphony, that progression you just mentioned. And then in the last movement, you're going to say, gee, I think I know this, not knowing that you just listened to it 15 minutes ago.
And he just ended the two movements with the more relaxed version of that triple chord, both the first and the end of the symphony
exactly
at the end of the fourth.
The very final, first of all, to end a symphony of this size and this magnitude and this much music making and very soft, subtle decay as a sigh of relief, like...
Exactly.
It's just a release of tension. He didn't want this big build-up like he did in 4
no.
and in 1, you know, where it's grandiose and huge and da-da-da-da. And the thing, but this one just, you just sit in your chair and the final chord just goes,
You betcha.
Isn't that beautiful? And you'll see that the audience will react to that differently. It's not like they're going to jump to their feet. They're going to just kind of slowly applaud, and then it'll pick up momentum once they realize, wow, that's
yeah.
touching, and it left me in a really beautiful place.
Second movement has that nice chorale-like sound. The third has that lyricism for which Brahms is so famous.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. You're talking about dee-da-da, dee-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful tune, and I think everyone knows that tune. If I'm, you know, it seems recognizable. It must have some commercial value to it. Do you know anything about that?
I saw and did not follow a list of, I think it was on the Wikipedia page of commercial and film uses where that symphony has been, and there was a whole list, but I didn't scroll down it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been used quite a bit because mm-hmm. I think people recognize that tune, and he just uses it so beautifully and passes it back and forth, you know, from the cello to the horn and bassoon. And one of the things I love about Brahms is his use of color. I think his color choices are what attracts me to this composer. I mean, the use of that cello, bassoon, horn color, viola color, you know, it's a little bit of the unsung hero of the orchestra. You know, it's not always in the first violin part or the trumpet part or the flute part. He gives this beautifully rich, deep color, a beautiful voice often, and I think that's what attracts me to him. And again, in the first movement, his use of rhythm is just extraordinary. The use of the hemiola, I mean, it's constantly
uh-huh.
changing back and forth, back and forth. You know, I'm conducting it in 2, and it's got a 2 feel to it, but then
yeah.
he's constantly layering this 3 on top of the 2. And we think of, you know, 3 against 2 as being a very contemporary compositional idea.
Well, tell Bach.
Like, you know, yeah, I mean, Bach did it. Mozart did it. Beethoven did it very well, you know. And Brahms used it so effectively. So it's not new. Eurythmics are not something that we're just teaching now in the conservatory or the university level. These guys mastered it way before we knew what we were talking about.
Oh, let's see. Hans Richter conducted the premiere of that symphony. These are from liner notes. It said he proclaimed it to be Brahms' Eroica. It said it was well received, more so than the second. But here's a little interesting thing. Although Richard Wagner had died earlier that year, the public feud between Brahms and Wagner had not yet subsided. Wagner enthusiasts tried to interfere with the symphony's premiere, and the conflict between the two factions nearly brought about a duel. I don't know the source, except other than it was the liner notes for a Pittsburgh Symphony recording. But
I love it.
Oh, these scrappy musicians.
So I hope there's no pandemonium at the concert hall this Saturday.
Nah.
We'll have to heighten security. We're doing Brahms 3.